This is Robert Greenall. This is Robert Greenall. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Greatly appreciate y'all taking time today to join us for another live edition of Midrats. If you're with us live and you would like to get a word in edgewise of the conversation, a great way to do that, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's where you'll find the chat room. We'll be monitoring that during the course of the show to gather up your observations. And if you have a question you would like for us to direct to our guest, that also is a great place to do it. And if you have to take off and take care of some business, make some masks, go wash your hands or something equally appropriate to our day and age, and you want to see what you missed, remember you can always get the full archive by taking a shortcut and subscribing to the free podcast over at iTunes, Spreaker, or whatever other aggregator you may use. And shifting from the pre-stuff, going straight on to the show, today's topic, we're going to look at something that seems like an esoteric topic, but if you or somebody you love is involved and anything for the U.S. Navy, to the Merchant Marine, or for that matter, you're sitting there in Puerto Rico and wonder why everything costs so much money. The Jones Act is not just a theory, it's a practice. The practice has been with us for a century, and many of it hail it as the way that our Merchant Marine is able to survive in a very competitive environment globally. And there is an equally vocal argument that says that not only is the Jones Act unnecessary to do that, but it's counterproductive. Can a lot of the assumptions that those of us make about the Jones Act be wrong? Well, we're going to find out today and have our guest on board to discuss the Jones Act from probably one way to describe it would be from the skeptical school. And that's going to be Colin Grabo. He is a policy analyst at the Cato Institute's Herbert A. Stiefel Center for Trade Policy Studies. Colin, welcome to Midrats.
Gentlemen, thanks for having me on the show.
Really appreciate you. And I got to give Colin all credit for us. He saved us the trouble having to reach out and find folks. In a way, he started a conversation with us, I think, a little over a month ago. I don't know who the guilty party is, whether it was myself, my co-host, or one of my guests made a little bit of a comment about the Jones Act and said, well, there's more to the story. And after a little back and forth, I was like, well, come on, Midrats, let's talk. So, Colin, I really appreciate you throwing your hat in the ring because it is a complicated story. And I think one thing that makes it so complicated is, at least for everybody to lie alive today, it's something that has always been with us. And as such, it's just part of the environment. It's just one of our assumptions that we have of our existence. And I think a lot of that can prevent people from either having an open mind about it or to question their assumptions about it. So if I thought to, and you did a really good job along with your co-author, an article that I believe went out in 2018. Yeah, it was June of 2018. If anybody wants to Google it, you can just look at, it's titled The Jones Act, A Burden America Can No Longer Bear. It comes from the Cato Institute. And you did a good job kind of describing the birth of the Jones Act. So for our listeners who may not aware of what happened a century ago after the First World War, real quickly, talk about the birth of Jones Act.
Sure. First of all, I think you made a really perceptive point there where you said that the Jones Act is something that a lot of people have just always grown up with. It's all people have ever known. And I think there's a tremendous amount of status quo bias that explains some of the support for the Jones Act. Change is scary. It's better go with the devil you know. And so this is we do it, I think, for some in large part because this is the way we've always done it. But getting to your question of, you know, what is the Jones Act? How did it come about? What's the backstory there? So the Jones Act was passed in June of 1920. The Jones Act, I use the term to refer to Section 27 of that act rather than the act writ large, because there are a lot of different provisions within the Merchant Marine Act of 1920. Some of them deal, for example, with sailors' rights, so various provisions. But I'm only talking about Section 27, which restricts waterborne transport in the United States to vessels that are U.S. flagged, U.S. built, and at least 75% U.S. crewed and U.S. owned. And the story there, most people say, well, the Jones Act came about because the United States had insufficient shipping to transport troops and supplies and equipment in World War I from the United States over to France where it was needed. But the backstory is actually a little bit more complicated than that. The United States, 1920 does not mark the onset or the advent of cabotage provisions for the United States. You can trace similar provisions to the similar Jones Act style provisions as far back as, I think, 1789. One of the first acts of Congress was to pass restrictions on who could carry goods on water from one point in the United States to another. Now, back then, it wasn't a straight prohibition. It was just saying that foreign ships could carry goods, but they were subject to tremendous taxes, much heavier than what was imposed on U.S. flag vessels. So on a de facto basis, it was very restrictive. And then in 1817, the United States just went ahead and flatly prohibited or restricted cabotage to U.S. flagged, U.S. built, U.S. crewed vessels. So that, you know, raises the question, why was the Jones Act necessary? Why was Section 27 included if we already had these sorts of laws on the books? And the backstory there is that there were some loopholes. Or as time went by, U.S. shipping in the beginning, going back to the colonial days, was very competitive. The United States had excellent shipbuilders, excellent mariners. U.S.-built ships, I think, comprised something like one-third of those found in the British fleet. Back in the colonial days, U.S.-built ships were considered to be of excellent quality and were something like 30 to 50% cheaper than those built in Europe. So restricting cabotage to U.S. ships was not considered very costly. In fact, in the book The Abandoned Ocean by Andrew Gibson and Arthur Donovan, they say this is basically a cost-free restriction because the U.S. was so competitive. But as time went on, and especially around the mid-1800s, the U.S. started to fall behind. We went from the era of wooden ships to, of course, ships using steel or iron and steam, and then on to steel, and the U.S. fell behind. This was a protected market. There wasn't as much the competitiveness wasn't there. The U.S. started to fall behind. And as the U.S. fell behind, shipping rates went up. People started to look for loopholes and ways to get around the Jones Act, or around these cabotage provisions, I should say. And one way they were able to do that back in the early 1900s was in the Alaska trade. Instead of sending goods directly from the United States to Alaska, what you could do is send it over land up to Vancouver, and then from Vancouver on a foreign flagship up to Alaska. And that way you didn't have to use a U.S. expensive U.S. shipping. The reason this is permitted is because the cabotage laws, they governed voyages. Well, if something went over land to Vancouver, that was not considered a voyage, so it was fine. Anyway, 1919 rolls around. Senator Wesley Jones of Washington State, he starts holding many months of hearings about the state of the U.S. Merchant Marine because it was found to be insufficient in World War I. And in February of 1920, he held a hearing in which some of his constituents, some shipping companies from Seattle, testified and said, hey, if you're looking to improve the state of the U.S. Merchant Marine, well, we have a situation where we are facing competition from foreign shipping. You know, we're being undercut by competitors out of Canada, out of Vancouver, the Vancouver area. And we'd appreciate it if you would amend the existing laws to just say that you can only use a U.S. ship to go from one U.S. point to another U.S. point, and that includes anything going over land. and to basically cut out these Canadian competitors. And that's exactly what happened. If you look at the language that these shipping companies proposed, I would say it's about 70 to 80% of what makes up the Jones Act today. So I apologize for the long-winded answer to that. That is why we have the Jones Act, and that's why the Jones Act came about in its current form.
Yeah, let me talk a little bit about, or ask you a question about the there are I guess three major components of the Jones Act as far as shipping goes. One is the inland waters, the rivers, and the I guess the intercoastal waterway, and the Great Lakes. And I gather that the concerns that you have and other people have expressed are not necessarily with those shipping requirements as much as it with ocean shipping. Is that a fair statement?
I think so. If you look at U.S. waterborne shipping, the supporters of the Jones Act often trot out the statistic. They say there are 40,000 vessels in the Jones Act fleet. Well, yeah, there are, but the emphasis is on vessels, not ships. You know, I think there are 31,000 barges alone, and I think, 22,000 barges on the Mississippi River alone, and then you have 5,000, 6,000 tugboats, pushboats. This is a fairly competitive industry for two reasons, because one, they build at scale. You know, they build, I think, usually in a given year, over 1,000 barges get built, so there's scale. There's lots of competition. Both there are different barge companies to choose from. They have to compete against other forms of transportation like trucking and rail, so they have to stay on their toes. And I think if we were to reform the Jones Act, you could leave the inland sector alone, and there's not a lot of gains to be had there. I think the real gains that could be realized are in the coastal shipping, the shipping that goes to the United States, the non-contiguous states and territories, as well as in our coastal waters.
And let's pull the thread on that a little bit. As somebody who has spent a few years of his life both in Puerto Rico and Hawaii, one of the things that is really apparent there is it costs, living on an island, it costs a lot more. A lot of things people here in CONUS take for granted, volume, just transportation costs are not significant. What percentage of that do you think impacts for those people that live in Puerto Rico and Hawaii?
That's really difficult to say. It's a great question. It does cost more to live there. And critics of the Jones Act often say, the Jones Act is responsible for a lot of that. And I think supporters of the Jones Act will push back and say, well, if you live on island, and especially, Hawaii, which is just geographically one of the most remote places on Earth, it's going to cost more. That's just built in. That's baking the cake. So how much is the Jones Act responsible for that? Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of studies there. There's never been, for example, a study of the Jones Act's impact just on Hawaii. There was a study done on the Jones Act's impact on Alaska back in the mid or late 1980s by the GAO, the Government Accountability Office. It concluded that the U.S. build requirement alone was, I think, equal to 2% of Alaskan personal income. So maybe that gives you some kind of sense for the cost. Puerto Rico, there was a study done by two economists at the University of Puerto Rico back in, I think, 2011 or so. It concluded the cost to Puerto Rico was in the neighborhood of $550 million, something like this. Last year, there was another study that came out that placed the cost at close to $1 billion. So it's a factor in Puerto Rico's problems. I'm not going to pretend that if you repeal the Jones Act, it would be the silver bullet and all of Puerto Rico's problems would go away. It's a contributor, but there's a valid debate to be had on how much of a burden it is. I think there's no question that it is a burden, but we can have a back and forth, and there is a debate to be had over what the size and scale of that burden is.
Yeah, I think one of the fascinating things about this is the debate, looking at the minority report that went along with the 1920 legislation, this debate about the about how this is going to affect the economy of the United States has been going on now over 100 years. It seems like it's almost the same debate. One side is saying we need the merchant ship system we have for defense purposes, and that encompasses the strategic shipping, the shipyards, the ship workers, the crews, and all that. And the other side is saying, well, that you're actually hurting those folks. Can you kind of how does the Jones Act hurt us in the terms of the defense structure that we claim that it is claimed that it helps out?
Yes. So, you know, traditionally the way the Jones Act debate breaks down is there's people that look at it through a strictly economic lens. And they say, well, you know, look at the provisions here. We have to use these really expensive ships. This is clearly a burden. And then I think supporters of the Jones Act tend to push back and they say, well, guys, there's a whole part here you're missing, which is that this is an asset to U.S. national security. It encourages the United States to have more ships and to have shipyards and have mariners to crew our ships. And those are all vital because, of course, we need to be able to move things from point A to point B in times of war or national emergency, and it pays to have a merchant marine that can be relied upon. But what I push back on is I say I think it's actually had a negative effect. And it's not too hard to understand why I say that, because one of the provisions, of course, is that you have to use a U.S.-built ship. Well, the problem is that U.S.-built ships, according to the Congressional Research Service, can be up to 5 times more expensive than one built in another country. So instead of paying $50 million for a ship, we're paying $250 million for a ship. And it seems to me, if you want more ships, it's bad policy to make them more expensive. So I think U.S. policy is working at cross purposes here. On the one hand, we want more ships, but we also want more shipbuilding. And so we support the shipbuilding sector by restricting people to U.S.-built ships. But it's not helping. So we're getting fewer ships because I think people have to pay out the nose for them. Back in the 1950s, the number of Jones Act ships was somewhere in the neighborhood of 450. In 2000, we were down to 193, and today we're at 99. And then on the shipbuilding front, well, the shipbuilding front is doing not so great either. Since the early 1980s until I think 2013 or so, roughly 300 shipyards closed of varying sizes here in the United States. Right now, there are only four major shipyards in the United States that build large ocean-going commercial ships. Two of those yards, the Philly Shipyard and V.T. Halter down Pascagoula, Mississippi, they are not currently building any large ocean-going ships. I think, let's see, in 2018, we built collectively, all U.S. shipyards built 3 large ocean-going ships. That was the El Koki, the Taino, and the Daniel K. Inouye. In 2019, there were only 2 ships delivered, the Kaimana Hila and the Lurline. And this year, we're on track to have 2 more, the Matsonia, and I think the George III. The next year, there's one ship is scheduled to be delivered, 2021-0. So on an average year, we're producing 2 or 3 ships a year. This isn't surprising because when ships are incredibly expensive, there's reduced appetite to buy them. So I think there was a report from the National Defense University that said U.S. shipyards are caught in what it called a cost-quantity trap. Basically, the costs go up, so the appetite to buy these ships is diminished, which in turn pushes the costs further up because to get your costs down, you need scale. And we don't have scale. You know, you go to South Korea, and I just mentioned that, you know, we build 2 or 3 ships in a year here in this country. You know, South Korea, that's what they do in a week. We can't get scale. And the incentives are totally misaligned to get the United States to a competitive place. Also, I think the Jones Act encourages U.S. shipyards to be kind of a jack of trades rather than, you know, master of none. If you look at European shipyards, they've had to cope or deal with competition from Asian shipyards. The way they've done that is they've focused on high-end specialty ships. For example, they'll build dredging vessels. They'll build cruise ships. They'll build offshore service vessels. Or fishing vessels and so on and so forth. And whereas the U.S., I mean, there's nothing the U.S. shipyards are really known for being excellent in. So they don't build for a world market. They build for a small captive market. So they can't get that expertise. They can't get scale. And the result is that we have a diminishing shipbuilding sector that just sells very expensive ships.
Here's a real interesting spreadsheet, for lack of a better phrase, table, actually, in the article that I thought was enlightening, because a lot of times people, and this is true in some places like Romania and Vietnam, places that have loose regulations, low labor costs, But there are, from 2014 to 2016, I'll just repeat for the listeners, the U.S. built 910,000 tons. Italy, 939. Germany, 1,287. In Japan, 39,535. And none of those are really low labor, low regulation economies. And indeed, those three countries, their shipbuilding industry was bombed into pulverized powder at the edge of living memory. But they are building so much more than we are. Are there some government policy? You know, we've been talking a little bit about the Jones Act, which is our government policy. Are there government policies in Germany and Japan and Italy, nations that are up to six times smaller than we are in population, that are responsible for them having such a relatively robust shipbuilding industry?
I think lots of countries have some kind of policy that, you know, puts a thumb on the scale. But I think if you want to talk about countries that really try to vigorously support their shipbuilding industries through government handouts, subsidies, you know, you're going to look at South Korea, you're going to look at China. I think those are the ones that are really trying to promote their shipbuilding sectors through those kind of policies. But I think the question we have to ask ourselves is, how much does that matter? If we were to take subsidies off the table and we just had this completely even playing field, what does that do to U.S. shipbuilding? What does that do to everyone else's shipbuilding? And what's interesting is that back in, I believe, 1992, the U.S. International Trade Commission tried to figure this out. And they said, well, if other countries got rid of their subsidies, what would that do to the price of their ships? And they got one set of figures from the OECD, which indicated the price would go up of foreign-built ships by, I think, 4.3%. They also took figures that were provided to them by the Shipbuilders Council of America, which is to say the Shipbuilders Trade Association here in the United States. They indicated it would be like 23.5%. And then I believe Harvard put out a study in 2006 indicating that for China, they're probably the biggest offender, it's either them or South Korea, the price of their ships would go up 13 to 20%. And on the one hand, you say, well, you know, that's significant. I mean, you know, that's not nothing. On the other hand, you have to put these numbers in the context of, we have a differential between our ships and their ships that is on the order of 300 to 400%. So I think that, you know, you take these subsidies and government handouts off the table, and U.S. shipbuilding is still far behind. And let's also acknowledge that handouts or assistance to U.S. shipbuilding goes beyond just the Jones Act. For example, the Austal shipyard in Alabama, it got, I think, a $5 million handout or tax advantage, something like this, from the government of Alabama to set up shop there. The Philly shipyard in Philadelphia, I believe they have a lease on the shipyard that they pay to the government of the city of Philadelphia that is $1 per year. And they've also gotten, I think they got some tax credits and things to buy some of their equipment that was on the order of, I think, several hundred million dollars. So we're not, you know, even take the Jones Act away, and we're hardly, you know, pure as the wind-driven snow when it comes to these government programs.
Well, yeah, I in my reading, of course, I've discovered that a lot of other countries have laws very similar to the Jones Act. In fact, it's a very small number of countries that don't have such a law. What is the difference between, you know, does that affect them the same way it's affecting us, or is it they don't have the restrictions on buying foreign flag ships if they're, say, New Zealand or Australia or someplace?
So you're absolutely correct that the vast majority of countries that have any appreciable amount of coastline, they have some kind of cabotage laws. But I think what we need to recognize here is that, you know, there are cabotage laws and then there are cabotage laws. There was an international organization, I can't remember which one, based in Switzerland, which the World Economic Forum referred to the Jones Act as the world's most restrictive example of a cabotage law, in large part because it has that U.S. build provision. There are very few countries in the world that have domestic build requirements. I think that MARAD, the Maritime Administration, did a survey back in the 80s of different countries and how many had domestic build requirements. I think it was like five or six in the entire world. And these were like, it was like Peru, Egypt, I think maybe Indonesia, you know, not countries you would associate with being major shipping or shipbuilding powers. And then there, of course, there was the United States. So cabotage restrictions are not unusual. Domestic build is incredibly unusual. Furthermore, if you look at the European Union, for example, there is cabotage permitted within the EU. So, you know, a Danish ship can transport something from France to Spain, for example. Also, other countries have cabotage exceptions or loopholes. For example, Canada has a provision that you can use a foreign flagship if no equivalent Canadian flagship exists. So if you want to transport something that requires, say, a bulk carrier, and for whatever reason they're not available, so you're not taking any business away from a Canadian ship, then you can go ahead and use a foreign flagship, and there's a waiver process you can apply for. And, you know, that would be great here in the United States because there are many types of vessels that just don't exist in the Jones Act fleet. For example, there are zero liquefied natural gas carriers, so it is impossible to transport U.S. natural gas from the Gulf Coast to Puerto Rico, which uses natural gas for about one-third of their power generation. So Americans can't sell an American product to another Americans because there are no ships to actually carry it. Same thing with liquefied petroleum gas, basically, you know, propane. We are the world's largest exporter of propane. We can't send any to Hawaii because there are no ships to carry it. There are none in the Jones Act fleet. So they will import it from as far away as West Africa instead of buying U.S. And another exception I just mentioned is in New Zealand, back in, I believe, the 1990s or early 2000s, they put an exemption in their cabotage laws that basically says if a ship is coming, a foreign ship is coming to New Zealand to drop off cargo, then while it's here, it can also transport something between the two islands before then moving on to another country. And just that provision alone saw, I think, shipping rates drop like 20 to 25%. So there are a lot of things. The good news about the Jones Act is, you know, we talk about it in usually binary terms. Do we keep it? Do we repeal it? But there's a lot of things that could be done well short of repeal that would provide, I think, substantial relief to the U.S. economy without getting rid of the law.
You'd think that being that everybody is kind of saturated with COVID-19 news for obvious reasons, that today's show might be a COVID-19 free zone. And originally I thought that it was, but as I was doing a little bit of self-generated show prep, the Jones Act has shown up in various places, and not just industry journals, but even over at The Hill that actually quoted the Cato study, bringing in the issue of the Jones Act in the response to COVID that's in line with a quote from your article from 2018, quote, "One component of national security is the capacity to respond quickly and effectively to natural and man-made disasters. In this area, the Jones Act falls short," unquote. Outline a bit the waivers people are looking for and some of the challenges adherence to the Jones Act gives us in responding not just to COVID, but very other man-made and natural disasters.
Well, like you said, you know, the Jones Act, one reason it was passed is to, you know, assure the United States of a fleet that could be useful in times of war and national emergency. But, you know, we found there have been numerous examples where we have some kind of disaster, some kind of emergency, and the Jones Act proves to be a hindrance, and waivers are issued to alleviate that. And, you know, the most recent example was during Hurricane Maria in 2017, there was a 10-day waiver issued for the Jones Act. I believe that 10 ships took advantage of that, 10 foreign flagships took advantage of that and transported supplies from the United States to Puerto Rico. I just think that in general, in time of war or national emergency, you want all the options you can have. You want all the assistance you can get. Why should we limit ourselves as to our shipping options, our transportation options? That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I think it's notable that during World War II, for example, the Jones Act was suspended, I believe, for the duration of the war, because it was an obstacle, and, you know, we needed all the options, all the help we could get. So why do we tie our own hands? And why do we have this requirement that you can only waive the Jones Act in time of war or national emergency? And furthermore, there's always resistance from the Jones Act lobby to these waivers, no matter how limited they are. We saw this past week. There was talk of the U.S. oil industry. Apparently, they were reportedly set to ask President Trump for a Jones Act waiver so they could use foreign flag ships to transport oil from the Gulf Coast up to refineries in the Mid-Atlantic and Northeast. It's repeatedly an obstacle. And I think that these examples show, why this law should be revisited. Why should we have an obstacle in our way when these events break out?
Well, I think one of the things that triggered our invitation to you to come on the show was a kind of a debate we were having on Twitter about LNG and the Northeast. And the question was, the Northeast U.S., during times of extremely cold weather, is importing LNG from Russia, among other places. I was suggesting that we could use barges, if nothing else, since apparently it's economically too difficult for U.S. shipbuilders to, or at least the ship users, to build a ship that would carry LNG on a coastwise trade. Talk a little bit about why that doesn't work. Why New England was forced to buy this Russian LNG?
Yeah, so both New England and Puerto Rico, when New England, you'll see a spike in demand for natural gas during the winter when temperatures drop and energy use rises. And like I said before, Puerto Rico uses natural gas for about one-third of its power generation. And whenever they have to bring in a ship to supply that extra natural gas, invariably it is foreign natural gas because, again, there are no ships under the Jones Act conditions to transport that LNG. And one obvious response is, well, guys, why don't you just build the ship, crew with Americans, and then problem solved? Well, the problem there is that, again, we have to go back to the lack of competitiveness of U.S. shipbuilding. The Wall Street Journal last year had an article about the Philly shipyard, and it mentioned that to build an LNG carrier in an Asian shipyard would cost somewhere around $180 million. To build one in the United States would cost about $700 million. So we're talking over $500 million more for one ship. Well, that ship is never going to be built. Who would buy that? I mean, the rates it would have to charge would be just prohibitive. So it just makes sense to instead import it from abroad. So this is an interesting example because here the Jones Act is just totally lose-lose. Because not only are consumers unable to buy U.S. LNG and U.S. producers are unable to sell it, well, it's not benefiting U.S. merchant marine either because it's not as though anyone's going out building these LNG carriers in a U.S. shipyard, so U.S. shipyard workers are getting work, and there are no extra mariners because of this. And the alternative is not that the ship gets built and then crewed with Americans. No, the alternative is the ship just doesn't get built, and it's just losers all around. So this example kind of crystallizes some of the problems with the Jones Act. There's just a severe lack of competitiveness. There's a severe lack of needed ships to meet the demands of the U.S. economy.
Well, you mentioned lose-lose. Let's talk a little bit about win-win, our potential loss. As in most things, follow the money. And a non-zero percentage of support or opposition to most governmental policies can be traced back to somebody's pocket, their financial interest. And as it stands right now, from a financial point of view, who nationally benefits the most from the Jones Act being in place? And contrary, if some of the more likely reforms or repeals of the Jones Act were able to make it through Congress and get signed by the president, whoever that may be, who would benefit from that financially?
Okay, good question. So who are the winners, and who are the potential beneficiaries of Jones Act reform? So the supporters of the Jones Act tend to break down into three main camps. These are going to be the U.S. shipyards. I mean, no surprise there. This is a law that says you have to build what they make. So they like that. Then you have the ship operators, the carriers. Well, they enjoy the limited competition that exists in the Jones Act world. You know, in the Hawaii trade, there are only two carriers that serve Hawaii. It's Matson and Pasha. In the Alaska trade, there are only two carriers. You have Matson, you have Tote. And then the Puerto Rico trade, there are only two carriers that have 85% of the container capacity, and that's Tote and Crowley. So you have duopolies all over the place. And sometimes people express surprise that carriers support the Jones Act because, or at least as it currently stands, or the U.S. build provision, because, again, it means that they have to pay obscene prices for their ships. But they like it. For two reasons. Number one, they're already bought into it. They paid these high prices, and if the domestic build requirement was to be repealed, the value of those ships would fall tremendously. But also, it's a barrier to entry. If someone wants to enter one of these trades and compete against them, well, you know, they have to pay, you know, extremely high prices for ships, you know, on the order of somewhere between $200 to $250 million for a container ship. Now, if ships were $50 million or $40 million, that would substantially lower the barriers to entry to compete, and they don't want that. And lastly, you have the unions that represent the mariners that crew these ships. They don't want to compete against foreigners that would be paid lower wages, which in turn would, you know, they'd have to either, they'd be driven out of business, or they would have to substantially lower their own wages in order to compete. So that's who tends, that makes up the foundation of the support for the Jones Act. And then as far as what sectors of the economy would benefit, you know, primarily or in large part, a lot of the benefit would go to anyone that ships items in bulk. So you're looking at the U.S. oil industry, for example. You know, they ship lots of oil. They would love to use foreign flag tankers, foreign-built tankers to transport U.S. crude at much cheaper price or finished product as well. Also, the agricultural sector. Again, another, you know, they love shipping. They're shipping cheap bulk items. Shipping really fits the bill nicely there. But I would also say that I think we would all benefit as Americans. I think that what's a real tragedy about the Jones Act is that it has made our ocean this vastly underutilized resource. We are, or at least we should be, very much a maritime country. We have, you know, the East Coast, West Coast, Gulf Coast, lots of major metropolitan areas along our coasts. We you know, have the Great Lakes, our great rivers, non-contiguous states and territories, and a mere 99 ships to serve it. And I think we would see this reorganization of domestic supply chains. It would make it easier for Americans to buy and sell things to one another. There are, you know, if you reduce the cost of transportation, I think it would just open up so many opportunities. And then lastly, one other thing I haven't mentioned here is there are environmental costs of the Jones Act. They're usually left out of the conversation. I think the Jones Act would have would benefit us environmentally. I say that mainly for two reasons. Number one, if you're going to send something from point A to point B, a ship is usually one of the most environmentally friendly ways of doing that, certainly in terms of carbon emissions. And then the ships, but we don't really use shipping very much. Ships account for, I think, something like 2% of freight transport in the United States. You know, in Europe, it's more on the order of 40%. Some of this can be explained by geographical distances. I'm not going to pretend that if we had got rid of the Jones Act, we'd shoot up to 40%. But clearly it'd be something north of 2%. And the ships that we do use tend to be older, less efficient, more polluting. And unfortunately, the Jones Act is a big disincentive to buying new ships. So people try to use their existing ships as long as possible. So, you know, we would have, I would think, especially, say, on I-95 corridor, on I-5 in the West Coast, we'd have fewer trucks going through our major cities. It's less maintenance for our highways. It's less pollution trucks going through major populated areas. So I think there would be a lot of benefits that, while some of these industries may feel them in particular, I think that all Americans would notice some kind of difference.
Yeah, I thought there was that MARAD, among others, had been pushing a maritime highway system to alleviate exactly the problem you describe and using and to encourage shipping by water. But you know, is that also affected by the Jones Act? Is that a whole different ball of wax we'd have to discuss some other time?
No, it's 100% affected by the Jones Act. Again, you know, the Jones Act comes down to it makes ships a lot more expensive. And it amazes me that MARAD, on the one hand, you know, they talk a lot about short sea shipping and trying to establish these marine highways. And on the other hand, they promote this law that makes that shipping much more expensive. It makes that, that serves as a severe disincentive to the use of our coastlines. And they always act surprised that Americans aren't really using it. How these guys are able to have a discussion about short sea shipping that doesn't acknowledge, at least acknowledge, the high cost of U.S.-built ships. And if we really want to get stuff off our highways, something we need to acknowledge or point out is that foreign flag ships going from U.S. port to U.S. port is something that already happens today. And you will find a foreign ship that will come over from Europe, South America, Asia, wherever, and they will stop at U.S. port and drop some stuff off and pick some stuff up and then go to another U.S. port. Now, they will not drop off the thing that they picked up in a U.S. port, but they will, again, drop off cargo that originated in a foreign destination or pick up cargo destined for a foreign destination. So we already have these ships going from port to port. And this is, like a conveyor belt along our coast that we are not allowed to use, that we are not allowed to take advantage of. I have a blog post, I think, last year where I just talked about short sea shipping and the obstacle that the Jones Act presents there. And I remember looking at one, I believe it was a government document, some kind of study, and they looked at, what kind of ships would be appropriate for short sea shipping and marine highways. And if you look at the document, it had the cost of these ships and said, well, if we build one of these ships, it'll cost this. If you build two, it'll cost this. If you build three, it'll cost that. And the dramatic reductions in the cost of the ship as you got to that third ship, that second, third ship, was significant. But again, in the United States, we don't build at scale, so we never get those cost reductions. So, yes, it's an excellent question. I think that our oceans are underutilized, and I think the Jones Act is a big reason why.
One thing that's popped into the conscious of a lot of people in the last month or so is some of the dangers of not balancing or trying to balance economics and national security in regards to offshoring a lot of the production of, if not significant parts of the supply chain, the entire production of important items. Recent last month, it's been things like masks and certain medicines that in extremist situations, you all of a sudden find that you don't have the ability domestically to ramp up production. Whether we're looking at specific or general reforms to the Jones Act, how do you incorporate trying to balance the economic math along with the national risk that can take place?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think there's we have a new appreciation for sourcing domestically in recent weeks because of the COVID crisis. And there's a new appreciation for being able to manufacture domestically and not have to rely on foreigners. But I think that a common mistake, misperception of the Jones Act is that it is the epitome of America first. That is the epitome of being self-reliant and avoiding these types of situations, because what happens is when U.S. shipping is very expensive, well, people will look for alternatives. And the Jones Act actually encourages Americans to buy more foreign products than would otherwise be the case. I mentioned, obviously, we've discussed LNG. We discussed LPG, oil. We will import oil from Saudi Arabia or Russia instead of buying it domestically, because getting it from one part of the United States to another part of the United States is too expensive. Last year Reuters had an article about California importing oil from Nigeria instead of the Gulf Coast because shipping is just too expensive. In 2013, the GAO did a study about the Jones Act's impact on Puerto Rico, and it goes beyond energy. They talked to people in the agricultural sector there that said, I think it was believed the Puerto Rican Farm Bureau, and they said a lot of times we can buy American or we can buy foreign. The prices are pretty similar, but we often buy foreign because once you factor in the transportation costs, it doesn't make any sense to buy American. So, look, I'm a free trader. I have no problem with imports per se. But I believe at the very least, this government shouldn't have its thumb on the scale encouraging Americans to buy foreign products that That report also mentioned, I believe, buying jet fuel from Venezuela, you know, instead of the United States. So it's a disincentive to self-reliance. It's a disincentive to domestic supply chains. And then this notion that, well, okay, we pay more, but at least, you know, we're self-reliant, I think is kind of an illusion, because these U.S.-built ships have lots of foreign influence in them. The shipyards that build the ships oftentimes are foreign-owned. The Philly shipyard is foreign-owned. V.T. Halter is foreign-owned. A couple of Amfels in Brownsville, Texas is foreign-owned. Fincantieri, Marinette in Wisconsin is foreign-owned. Then also the ship designs are almost always foreign ship designs that are bought under license from, you know, a lot of times South Koreans or others. And the components that go in the ship that actually make it function are oftentimes foreign. For example, I mentioned that I believe last year the Kaimana Hilo was built by Philly Shipyard. If you were to open up that ship and take a look at it, you'd find the maneuvering thrusters are made by Kongsberg of, I believe, Norway. The main generator engine is from Hyundai. The propeller is from Hyundai. The propulsion engine is from MAN Energy Solutions of Germany. The auxiliary boiler is from Alfa Laval of Denmark. So this notion that, you know, these are truly American is a little bit false. And at the end of the day, even in a war or national emergency, we are still reliant on foreign supply chains to build these ships.
Yeah, I think we also need to discuss the crews for these ships. I mean, American, I guess I've read the figure that American crews manning American ships cost about four times what a foreign crew would cost. But having worked in the industry, a lot of the foreign crew, you know, made up of Filipinos and other people from very poor countries, you know, they may be excellent sailors, but their living wage is a lot less than what we would expect to pay or earn as American sailors. And you know, we have one Merchant Marine Academy, National Academy, and then six state Maritime Academy. What are we going to do with all these graduates? I think it's, I don't know, maybe 3,500 or 4,000 a year that come out of those schools. What you know, that, are they looking at the high-paying jobs, or are they just not able to find jobs? And is there, are these unions going to agree to lower wages for the, you know, a third mate or a whatever?
Well, a few things here. Number one, the status quo is very bad for those graduates. You know, a lot of them have to take shoreside positions because positions on the ships don't exist, or they exist for a few years, but there's no room for advancement, and then they get out. So the status quo is pretty bad. If what we want to emphasize here is jobs for mariners, well, to me, the most straightforward thing to do is get rid of the U.S. domestic build requirement. If we had cheaper ships, I think we'd have more ships. More ships means more mariners. Another thing is, you know, I just think as a general principle, I'm against the concept of picking winners and losers. I think we need to take a holistic view of the economy and what's good for the economy. And I'm not sure we should prioritize, say, mariners over guys working the oil patch or something like that, or to say one job is more important than another. But I do recognize that mariners have an important national security role. Of course, in times of war, they can be mobilized to serve on either commercial ships that are chartered by the U.S. government, or they can be used to crew U.S. Sea lift vessels, and that's valuable. And one thing I proposed in a recent paper that was published in November is to say, you know, instead of having this Jones Act where we try to assure the mariner pool by these restrictions to U.S. crew and to U.S. flagged ships, why don't we set up a merchant marine reserve, something like that? These guys have the national security role. They should be compensated for that, and they should be their value should be recognized by the U.S. government, and setting up some kind of formal reserve, so that in times of war we know how many mariners are available, and we'll subsidize. I have no problem doing, say, wage subsidies to these guys that would give them an advantage to help them compete against foreign flagships, to assure that we do have an adequate supply of mariners, because right now, according to the U.S. government, we are something like 1,800 mariners short of what's needed to engage in a sustained sea lift campaign. So I think there are a lot of creative ways of dealing with this. Again, getting rid of U.S. build is a no-brainer. And then to the extent we need mariners to crew our ships, I'm totally open to the idea of either wage subsidies or establishing a formal reserve for these guys that would compensate them and recognize the mission that they perform.
As with most things that involve politics, you can't get the perfect, but you often get the good. And I'd be interested in your take of what you thought from a reform point of view might be some of the low-hanging fruit that we would get the most bang for the buck and would be most likely to succeed. And pulling the closest things I could reach, I think the argument could be made a couple of reforms that might be easy to get would be a reform that would allow things such as you described wonderfully, the specialized boat that's used to service offshore wind turbines, that a ludicrous rule would forbid it from being used. That and some of the non-Jones Act compliant vessels having cabotage rights similar to what they have in New Zealand. Are those two of the ones you think would be politically the most palatable? Are there other ones you think that would be the first things we might be able to see reformed in piecemeal if you can't do wholesale?
You know, like I said before, I think too often this discussion about the Jones Act is binary. It's do we keep it, do we get rid of it? And the good news is there's a lot of things we could do well short of repeal that would, I think, be very useful and produce some real benefits. One of those things that I would recommend is the waiver system. There is no waiver system here for the purposes of economic need. The only waiver system we have is for purposes of national defense. So, again, I go back to the LNG issue or LPG issue. If a certain type of ship does not exist in the Jones Act fleet, then we should be able to use a foreign ship. These are examples, again, where if you had a waiver system, U.S. Merchant Marine doesn't lose anything because, again, it's a line of business. It's a service they're currently not offering, so it's not as though the alternative is they get the work. This is just a total obvious win-win to me that we should move forward with. And, you know, I also say I have no problem doing an incremental, gradual approach. I'm fully aware and cognizant of what I'm advocating here is a real sea change and a dramatic departure from the status quo, and that's scary. And I have no problem doing something incremental and going step by step and, you know, doing some reform, pausing, looking around, you know, studying what are the impacts been. Is this good or bad? Is this serving our national interest? And then, you know, again, moving forward. So a waiver system to me would just be an absolute no-brainer. Americans should be able to take advantage of ship types. Just because a ship doesn't exist in the Jones Act fleet doesn't mean Americans shouldn't be able to use that kind of ship. And the way you could assure that that wouldn't come at the detriment of the U.S. Merchant Marine is just if a U.S.-built ship, you know, if a U.S. flagship does ever get built, then the waiver goes away. So, you know, no one gets harmed there. So there's definitely rooms for win-win or at least scenarios where nobody, there's no obvious loser. Again, another thing, like you mentioned, limited cabotage movements. We have lots of foreign ships coming into our ports. Why not take advantage of them? There is zero deep draft commercial container shipping along the East Coast, for example. So if you were able to load something onto a foreign ship and take it from Boston to Miami, again, no one in Jones Act world is losing because that's not a service they're offering. So limited cabotage movements. And then I do think we need to do something about the non-contiguous states and territories. If for no other reason than the current approach, I think is just grossly unfair to them. If you buy into the logic of the Jones Act and that by having the Jones Act, it produces more ships, more mariners, more shipbuilders for us. Well, something like, you know, I want to say a third of Jones Act shipping and 100% of the container shipping is all going to those non-contiguous states and territories. So why are those guys all footing the bill for something that benefits all of us as Americans. To me, that's not fair. You know, I would propose a Jones Act exemption for those non-contiguous states and territories, but at the very least, maybe a subsidy program or something that spreads that pain across all Americans. I just don't think the current setup is very fair, is very just, especially when you take into consideration the fact that Puerto Rico has a 43% poverty rate. And there's a lot of discussion here in D.C. How do we help Puerto Rico? A lot of people have different ideas. I think at the very least, we should just stop hurting them. And I think the Jones Act is definitely an imposition upon them. Again, there's a legitimate debate to be held about how big of an imposition that is. But I think that's something we definitely need to take a look at.
Yeah, I'm gonna add an arrow to your quiver, Colin, because one of the other things that we've seen is U.S. Corporations, especially oil corporations, owning refineries in foreign countries, which they will then ship refined product on foreign flagships to the U.S. to be put into U.S. system, they're paying a lot less for labor on the ships. They may even own the ships, but a lot less for labor on the ships. Ships don't cost as much. But the refineries aren't necessarily bound by the kind of environmental laws that we have in this country. So this works because of the way the Jones Act works. They can't, you know, it's just importing a refined product, and that doesn't seem to, you know, we're losing jobs that are being held by the refinery workers and on those ships that are foreign flagged. And that having been said, we're coming on an hour. You've been very kind to devote an hour of your time to us. What can we look for from you in the next few weeks, months, days that involve these topics? And if people are interested in this stuff, where can they find more of your writings on these topics?
Well, guys, first of all, I just want to say it's been an absolute pleasure. I think these have been great questions. It's been a great discussion. I've really enjoyed it. If people want to learn more, they can go to cato.org/Jones Act, and all our Jones Act stuff is there. If they want to read more, if this has piqued their interest, I can also be found on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @CPGravos. That's CPGRABOW. It's full of Jones Act content, and you can look forward to, you know, plenty of op-eds and blog posts in the weeks and months to come.
And Colin, I think that might be the only time in history somebody has used the marketing term, quote, "it's full of Jones Act content," unquote. But we're small. So we're a small, bespoke community of people, though, that is excited and it is interesting. And I would encourage everybody, whether they agree to your position or not, to read Steel Refined Steel. You either sharpen your argument or you. Colin, I do greatly appreciate you taking time on this Sunday. Help us get something to self-isolate with, and Midwest is always good for a dollar of that.
Excellent.
And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Midrats. Until next time, hope you have a great day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so please a friend and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to Rome, it's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.